Welcome, welcome, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Benerit.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're going to spend the hour listening to a couple of recent interviews about the human body.
And Cherry, we're going to start with the science of smell.
Yeah, you walk down the street past a hot dog cart and you're instantly transported to a Phillies game. You're washing your hands at work and that soapy smell reminds you of your grandmother's house. Our sense of smell has an incredibly powerful hold over memory and emotion. Companies will even tap into it to entice us into stores and build brand loyalty.
I'm on to you, Auntie Anne. On to you. We got curious about our favorite smells, why we like them, and how they have such strong connections to happy and sad times in our lives. Brown University neuroscientist Rachel Herz studies the psychological science of smell and has consulted with companies to develop fragrances. She joined us in Studio 2 to help us make sense of scents. Let's take a listen.
So, Rachel, we want to start by laying the foundation, and I want you to explain to us what happens in our brain when we get a whiff or a smell of something. How does it go from the air into us interpreting it into our minds?
Okay, sure. So let me give you a really quick sense of smell 101. So the first thing is that all smells are chemicals, whether they're created in a lab or they come out of the rose bush or anywhere. They're chemicals that float through the air, and they have certain physical and chemical properties that enable them to interact with olfactory sensory neurons and produce the experience of smell. And so what happens is when we're walking around breathing and inhaling through our nostrils, the air that's always carrying a whole complex soup of different chemicals with it, some of which we actually cannot smell. And something that I find super fascinating is that the air itself, the chemicals that make up the air itself, oxygen, hydrogen, helium, nitrogen, and so on, we actually can't smell those chemicals. Mm-hmm. So the sense that we do smell, it's like the air is a white canvas and the different smells are the colors that are painted on it or something to that effect is the way I like to visualize it. But anyway, when you're inhaling, those different molecules are being brought up through the nasal passages, and they then land on this patch of mucous membrane where the olfactory sensory neurons, the neurons that are detecting scent, are. And they're literally directly exposed right out there, and they're interacting with these chemicals and producing responses. And then that response gets put into the brain, and we say, aha, lemon or kombucha or my grandmother's soap.
Okay.
Wow.
So that's interesting. Mm-hmm. But what's also interesting to me is how personalized our sense of smell is and how tied to memory it is. So I'm going to read in a couple of comments here. Kevin in Hellertown says, for anyone who has loved larger boats in the Jersey Shore, the smell of a mix of diesel exhaust and salt air is very intoxicating. That's Kevin in Hellertown. And then Jim says low tide down the shore is one of his favorite smells. And he says it's controversial because it's a sulfurous smell. And I believe, if I have my research right here, that you, for instance, are a fan of the smell of skunk. So I just read off three smells that I think a lot of people would say are bad smells, but that for some people are truly, truly appealing. How do we explain that?
Okay, well, the part of the brain that's doing the conscious perception of smell and the part of the brain that is processing emotion, emotional memories, association, and learning are actually the exact same part of the brain. So our conscious perception of scent and emotion and associations and memory are all conjoined. And so when we first experience the scent, the context, the situation that we're in, the experience we're having at the same time that's occurring gets connected to that scent, and the emotional meaning of that experience, it is what dictates how we respond to that scent. So for example, I will talk about myself here with respect to the smell of skunk. The first time I ever smelled it, I was in the back seat of the car, summer day, windows rolled down, family in the car, my mom's, you know, talking in the front seat. All of a sudden, there's a new scent in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And my mom says, I love that smell. So I'm like, I love mommy, beautiful day. I love that smell too. And it wasn't until several years later on the school ground when that same scent came into nasal view. And I said, oh, I love that smell. And then everyone went, ew, you're so weird. That's skunk. And I never even knew that was supposed to be a bad smell.
What's so fascinating though to me, Rachel, is how locked in your sense of the smell of skunk is just from the original experience. Like, why doesn't that get filtered out over time?
So that is a brilliant question. The reason is that our first association when it comes to smell is the one that gets most tightly embedded, unless the subsequent one that we may have is super powerful from an emotional perspective. So when we have the first association we experience with a scent, it's like that becomes embedded in our memory, and subsequent associations are really hard to reconnect with. It's like if you had a first telephone number and it was always interfering with any other telephone number you could ever get, and you were only ever remembering your first telephone number. Now, the situation with emotion, because emotion is really a key in terms of making this association, is that if you have a really powerful subsequent emotional experience with that same scent, and typically it's a negative one, then that first association gets wiped out. So this is what happens when people have PTSD, where scent is a really potent trigger, so post-traumatic stress response, where the aroma or scent that was associated with that trauma, then even if it was something that was previously liked, is now something that's really awful because it's triggering this recollection of the trauma because the trauma is so emotionally intense. So like a cologne, for example, that an assailant wore, even if you used to like it, now it's horrible because it's connected to this really traumatic experience.
Well, I want to broaden the conversation a little bit from the personal memories to more like, things that we associate with certain aromas. Because I believe in aromatherapy. I have lavender spray that I will spritz on the pillow at night to help relax me and go to sleep. The smell of citrus and orange makes me feel a little bit more energized and can wake me up if I'm feeling a little sluggish. So I want you to talk about that because you've said with scent, you can get an immediate emotional reaction and not even understand why. How is it that certain scents can literally be used for therapy in folks, even if they may not have a specific memory linked to a particular smell?
Well, I'm going to have to say that you have learned the connection between lavender and relaxation through marketing, through experiences where you've
So I can
had
manipulate
a relaxation. So,
it.
I mean, this is something which is really powerful with, and we probably are going to get to it, really powerful with the sense of smell because scents are invisible and because they are so foundationally connected to emotion and association. If I tell you this is what a scent is and this is what it does, most of the time, that's the association that you'll make to it, and then subsequently the responses will follow accordingly. So you've learned through all kinds of experiences in your life that lavender is relaxing, and you actually don't have a bad experience when you smell it, because some people, depending upon actually their specific olfactory neurons, may actually find it super intense or may smell it somewhat differently if they don't have some of the same receptors. But for you, it's a good smell and the marketing has worked. And so it does truly relax you. Like I like to say, aromatherapy is real, but it doesn't work like a pharmacological magical trick. It works because you learn the association. And actually, the fact that it's an immediate response, relaxation, invigoration, whatever the case might be, is further proof that it's not pharmacological. If it was pharmacological, it'd have to take some time. The chemicals would have to work itself through your system. Then you would end up feeling it. But because it's immediately connected to that conscious perception and the emotion, you get the instant relaxation or the instant rejuvenation.
And then me, I spread it out, I guess, to other folks. I'm like, oh, you're a little, you can't sleep. Let me spray this on your pillow and you'll feel it. And so it's almost like a psychological trick in a way that, somehow, some way along the way of life, someone told me that. I took it in and believed it, and
You
now
internalized
I
it.
internalized it, and now it works. And that's sort of
Right.
how, yeah, go ahead.
No, but it's actually, but it's still really real. It's not really a
Right.
trick. I mean, so
Okay.
we kind of like to dismiss it if it seems like it's quote unquote psychological, but our emotions, if you want to think of them that way, are all psychological. Like if someone was really awful to you and you felt really upset, you'd have all kinds of physiological, neurological, psychological responses to that. And all that happened was an emotion. And what happens with smells is they become connected to emotions, and then they act like proxies for the emotions that when you smell them, you feel the emotion. So it's real that you feel relaxation, and you've been spreading the word with lavender. So you've been giving other people that same experience, but it is real. It's just not through some mystical, magical, drug-like interaction.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, Rachel, about companies and smells and how they market smells. We see a lot of companies will develop smells for a retail space. How does that process work? And like, what's the target they're aiming for there? Because sometimes I step into a store and I hate the smell that they've infused the place with. But what are they aiming for when they're trying to develop those in-store experience smells?
So great question. So there's a couple of things going on. First of all, they're hoping that you'll like the smell and that actually it could make you linger longer in the store space. And chances are the longer you linger, the more likely you are to maybe pick something up and bring it to the cashier and therefore make a purchase. The other thing they're trying to do is, depending upon what they're selling, they're trying to potentially elevate the value perception of what it is so that you think maybe this is higher end, higher quality, better value, whatever the case might be. So they're potentially working with a scent that they think is going to connote a greater quality to the merchandise that they're selling. And they're also, and this is obviously, you know, some of the problem, but it's always quite individualistic. They're potentially targeting a specific demographic of people who are coming into their store. And so depending upon where you fit in that, maybe the scent just doesn't work for you. But it's also the case that actually they often don't test out enough boots on the ground, as it were, or noses on the ground for figuring out what actually works for different people. And because there's always this slight bit of variability with everybody, both based on personal experiences that you might have with the scent or just the genetics of your olfactory receptors, and they're ever so slightly different for every single person, that the same scent doesn't smell the same way to you as it does to me or anybody else. So there's a lot of things going on, but what they're trying to do basically is create a more multi-sensory environment to get you to like the space more and like the scent and linger longer to make purchases, and also to perceive the value of what they're selling as being greater.
And Rachel, I think about when I go to certain luxury hotels and you walk into the lobby and there's this wonderful smell, or you go into a spa and it smells a certain kind of way and you're just like, ooh, I feel relaxed already. I want you to give us a few examples of, you know, this scent marketing and you know, its effectiveness, how it has worked.
Yeah, so I don't know if you want me to talk about particular brands or not, but I'd
just one or two. Yeah, just so we can envision it. Yeah, working.
Yeah. So I know, for instance, the Sheraton hotel chain, also Marriott. There's a lot of, for instance, if you ever go to Las Vegas, each of the resorts there has a specific signature scent. Bellagio, for instance. Also, even McLaren Airport. I don't know if it still does, but for a while it had a signature scent. So as soon as you landed in the airport, you were like, this is Viva Las Vegas. So you had this like specific scent that greeted you when you got off the plane. And in cases like that, where it's like a big environment, like an airport or a resort or a spa, like you mentioned, well, that's not so big, but these more kind of distinctive environments where you're not necessarily buying things in it, but you're sort of potentially spending money to be there, then the idea is that the signature that's associated to the brand, you know, if it's the hotel chain or if it's a specific resort, you know, brand, whatever it is that that then is part of the whole signature of the environment itself. And so often what they'll do is they'll also have soaps and shampoos in the hotel rooms or the resort rooms that are also scented with the same product. And spas typically do this too. So they'll use lotions and things like that that are, they're related to the smell that is there when you first walk in. And then hopefully you're like everybody and steal a few of those little products to bring home with you. And then the next time that you smell those, you're like, oh, I had the greatest time. I'm going to use Las Vegas as the example. I had the greatest time at this resort in Las Vegas. Wow, this is really making me want to go back there because of the emotional associations and memories that you have. And so you're going to go back to the same resort because it's created this like traveling in your suitcase scent-triggered branding advertisement, as it were, so that instead of saying, oh, you know, maybe I'll try The Wind next time, or I'll try, you know, Caesar's Palace, because you have this scent that's connected, hopefully, to a really good time, you're going to keep being a repeat customer. And that when you go back there, also, you're comforted by the fact that, yes, this is the experience. When I walk in, it smells like this. I'm here. I'm getting this reliable experience again. And that's actually what works with these hotel chains. So you could be in a Sheraton anywhere in the country, and if it smells the same, then you're going to feel this kind of comfort. I know what I'm in for. It's going to be fine. It's all going to be good. It's what I expect.
If you're just joining us here on Studio 2, Avi Wolfman-Arendt here with my co-host Cherry Gregg talking about smell, and our guest is Rachel Herz. The thing that I would be worried about, Rachel, as a company, is the possibility that my scent repels just as many people as it attracts. But maybe that's a decent trade-off, because if I can just get a small segment of very, very loyal people who love my scent, it doesn't matter that, you know, half the people will never come back. I mean, how do companies think about those trade-offs when it comes to developing a scent? Because I can't imagine there is one universally beloved scent.
No, you're absolutely right. There is not one universally beloved scent. Although if there were anything, it would probably be vanilla. And that's because the scent of vanilla is actually also in breast milk as well as formula. So everybody who's alive today has either had breast milk or formula. And that's comforting, soothing, being held, nutrition, first experiences with love are bonded to the scent of vanilla in that respect. But that being said, the idea here is actually what you're saying is absolutely true. And there have been studies which have shown that, let's say in the lab, I say these two fragrances, I like them equally, they're great and so forth. And then I bring them into the context of the store and particular product. Let's say I have a high-end clothing store for women, and I have previously tested these two fragrances. Women shoppers who are likely my demographic say they like them both equally, but now they're in the store setting and one of them really hits and the other totally backfires. And it's been shown that if a scent backfires, it's actually worse than having no scent at all. So it can actually be quite negative, and people do want to avoid that. So the way to kind of work around this is really think hard about what it is that you're selling and what is conceptually connected from a fragrance perspective. And that can be pretty difficult, because unless you're selling something like coffee or flowers, which have literal scents connected to them, it's hard to kind of think of what might be the right scent for something which is more conceptually abstract. So there is a real problem here. And I would say that the trade-off should not be 50-50, 50 love it and 50 hate it, but rather that, you know, at least 75 like it, because since it's worse than no scent at all, I don't think that many stores will want to take the risk of a 50-50, you know, hit or miss.
And I got to ask you this question, because I lost my sense of smell for about a month plus when I had COVID the first time. Everything tasted badly. Things just felt a little duller. I want you to sort of talk about what happens to folks when they don't have this sense of smell, and how important is our sense of smell to us just enjoying life?
Well, you said we only have it a minute and a half, so I can't say very much about this. You could probably tell I could talk for a long time. Well, first of all, our sense of smell is actually involved in everything in our lives. And when people lose their sense of smell, it can really be, you know, a total reconfiguration, usually for the negative, of their entire life experiences. Now, it's not always that way. And actually, you know, there are people who are born without a sense of smell, and they are different from people who acquire loss of smell throughout their lives from the point of view of how they cope with it. Or people who just, everyone kind of varies. So there are certain people that just, they were also born with a kind of a weak sense of smell, or some people who are born with very acute sense of smell for particular kinds of chemicals, and that may make them also like super sensitive depending upon the environment or the smell that they're having. But we're so emotionally connected to smell that, you know, whether it's too little or too much, we can feel that that's bad, and it can shape everything that we experience moving forward.
Oh, so much more we can say about this. That's Rachel Herz, a neuroscientist who studies the psychological science of smell at Brown, and the author of numerous books on smell, including The Scent of Desire and Why You Eat What You Eat. Rachel, thanks for the time.
Thank you so much, Sherry and Abby. It's great to be on.
When we get back from the break, we're going to rewind back to our discussion about the controversial proposal to pay people to donate their organs. Stick with us. Lots to come. This is Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manera.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're spending the hour listening back to some of our recent interviews about the human body. And we turn now to a controversial proposal that sparked a lot of discussion.
There is a shortage of organs for transplant in the United States. More than 100,000 people are on the national organ waiting list. Thousands die each year before they get a transplant.
So how do you increase the number of donors? One idea is to get more living donors by offering financial incentives. And there is a movement to do this called the End Kidney Deaths Act. So would you give a kidney to a stranger for some kind of monetary compensation? And what ethical questions would that raise? We invited three guests to talk about our organ donor system and the pros and cons of paying living donors.
They are physician, transplant recipient, and advocate for compensating living donors, Gregory Hess, medical ethics professor, Art Kaplan, and Lauren Shepherd, who donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. Let's take a listen. Greg Hess, I wanted to start with you. Give us a sense of the scope of the problem here and the consequences of this gap between the number of donated organs and the people who need one.
Sure. It's a growing problem, and that's one of the reasons that the solutions are being proposed that you spoke about. But briefly, you know, we have anywhere between 90,000 to 100,000 people on the transplant waiting list waiting for an organ. And while that's happening, of course, particularly for kidney patients, they're failing every day. They're getting worse and worse. And then they get to the point that they're actually so sick that they have to be taken off the waiting list. And unfortunately, they pass away.
And so, about how many donations are there in a given year? So there's 90 to 100,000 waiting, and about how many organs available?
Yeah, it varies by which organization counts them and exactly when, et cetera, but it's roughly 25,000 kidney donors per year, or excuse me, kidney transplants occur per year.
And so walk us through the process for folks who may not understand how you go about giving a kidney and receiving a kidney. Walk us through that process.
Sure. Generally, it starts with a phone call, and you call a transplant center. And they would ask you to register, fill out a form online. And then from there, you'll get a call from the transplant center. They'll then confirm the information that you've put in there. Then eventually, it'll lead to where you actually go in person to the transplant center. And they'll put you through a very thorough physical, as well as CAT scans, things along those lines to look at your health. And then also mental health. If you would, discussion or exam, and then very much so on that last point to make sure that you're not being coerced and that you're doing it of your own free will. Hopefully, very thorough informed consent so you understand the risk and the benefits, and that then people would move through the process. It takes quite a bit of time, but I would say in general, the average is probably about 6 months between when you start and when you might be able to donate.
And so you believe, your argument is that people should be compensated to go through this process.
They should, for a variety of reasons. But to me, the most important piece along that line is that this is a proposed study. So it's a pilot study. And the way we advance things in medicine and science is to look at the data, look at the facts. So right now, we know the facts are this would just be for altruistic, meaning non-directed donors donating to a stranger. Last year, we had 400 people donate. So we're not starting out with a dramatic number here. But we are hoping that with this compensation, based on studies and things done before, that this would definitely accelerate it. And we're hoping for 6,000 people a year donating rather than 400. And that if that's tracked over a 10-year period, we'll learn the facts and data from this. Does it work? Does compensation actually both protect the donors and benefit the recipients?
And just to clarify, you're talking about this proposed End Kidney Deaths Act. 10-year pilot program would provide a $50,000 refundable tax credit over 5 years to living kidney donors. And I think there are some details within that, but that's the broad scope of this one proposal. Of course, it has generated some backlash, and I want to bring in a caller now. This is Will, who wants to weigh in. Will, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. Actually, it's Bill, and I live in West Mount Airy. I'm a 71-year-old guy, and I've given blood over 80 times, and I'm shooting for 100 times. So I'm very big on organ donation. I also wrote my PhD dissertation on an issue in medical ethics. So I think that it's wrong to compensate people for this for several reasons. One is when you give altruistically without getting compensated, you're more likely to not need the money. You know, I think if people are compensated, especially a huge amount of money like $50,000, there'd be a lot of pressure on poor people from within themselves as well as their friends and neighbors to give their organs. And also with the experience of paying people for blood, the blood is generally not as good quality as it is when somebody gives altruistically for free. And so I really think this is an important issue. And I tried to give my kidney about a year ago, but I didn't qualify primarily because of my age and the condition of my kidney because I was older. So I really encourage people to donate, but not for money. I don't think money is a good idea.
Interesting. So that's Bill's perspective from Mount Airy. And I'm sorry I got your name wrong, Bill. I want to kick this now to Art Kaplan, mm-hmm. bioethicist at NYU. So you just heard one potential downside of a compensation program. Anything else to add in that vein, Art?
Well, there are important things to think about. We've had proposals for compensation for about 40 years, and they never go far because, first, there's major opposition from religious groups, Catholics, evangelicals, Orthodox Jews. They don't believe that you own your body, and it's not something they think you can commodify or sell. And you may say, well, I don't care what they think. It's up to me. But you don't want those people dropping out of a system because you create money for organs. Secondly, you're going to have to run a dual system. What we're talking about here is just for kidneys, but you can't do it for hearts or livers. You can't do it for lungs. And so it's too dangerous, by the way, for lungs to take one. So you try to run them against one another at the same time, and I think that would be hugely upsetting to the rest of the organ transplant world. I don't see the heart people and the liver people coming forward and saying, yeah, let's do a kidney market. That's the way to go. And by the way, we're not talking about donors anymore. We're talking about sellers as soon as we make the switch. It's nice to retain the altruistic language, but we have to describe it for what it is. I think the other reason to be cautious here is that there are things we need to try before we get into trying to regulate a market and risk, as the caller said, exploitation and even pressure on people. You know, pay your gambling debts. You got a kidney. Let's get out there and sell it. We have the opportunity to do what other parts of the world are doing, which is to switch from opt-in. I want to be an organ donor. I'm calling up. To the presumption that when you die, you will be an organ donor unless you opt out and basically say, I don't want to do it. In parts of the world that do that, Austria, Belgium, now Wales, Scotland, you do see significant increases. We don't have to speculate. It helps. And so we can make
the
shift.
Could that also incur some backlash from the same religious groups you mentioned earlier?
No, because you can still opt out. It's just saying you have a choice. We can frame it so that you have to jump into it, or we can frame it so that it's up to you to opt out of it or say, I don't want to do it, but you still retain the right, if you don't want to do it, not to do it. It just makes the default, it's a little bit like you don't have to eat your vegetables But if I put them in the lunch line first, maybe you're more likely to do it than if I put them at the end of the lunch line after all the desserts and other high-calorie things. So we could set up a assumption, but still give the freedom to say no. And let me mention one other reason there's a problem here. I know I'm on long here, but the transplant system right now is inefficient and has all kinds of problems in terms of cadaver donation as things now stand. Congress has basically said, fix it, and they're trying to shake it up. I'm not going to go into all the details, but there are ways to increase efficiency by better public campaigns, trying to put in right now a market and selling into the system as it is, efforts are underway to make it more efficient, I think would probably overwhelm the system. So just in practical terms, bad timing.
And our quick follow-up, I mean, what makes organs so different from other bodily, you know, issues that we sell, like sperm, blood, eggs from a woman? That's a real, when you talk about egg donation, that's a real process that women have to go through. Lots of vetting in order to make that happen. All those things are compensated for. Why would organs, and specifically kidneys, be different from those?
Well, two reasons. One, the sperm egg situation, they're renewable. So when you give that kidney, you're down to one. If you then get diabetes or an injury or something happens, you become in trouble in a very different way than a sperm or an egg seller might be. The other problem, if you will, is you've got a situation where you may get people trying to sell where you're going to promote the rich, the people who get the compensation start to move up to the head of the line, the poor start to fall behind. You get equity issues about trying to run this market with, you know, I want to sell my organ, but I only want to sell it to Jerry. I don't want to sell it to anybody else.
Greg, I just want to give you a chance to respond real quick, because I think there's this question in particular of, could we have a tightly regulated market around this that could be fair, that could be equitable, that could, you know, facilitate this exchange without becoming exploitative? Can you address that and perhaps a couple of the other points that Art brought up?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, we do not view this at all as exploitative. The fact is that right now, people who are in lower educational levels and lower income levels are disproportionately less likely to get a kidney transplant. If we provide compensation, and again, remember, this is just a pilot study for 10 years, starting out with only altruistic donors. It's not a get-rich-quick scheme. So if someone's in trouble with a, quote, gambling debt, those types of scenarios are, to me, really fantastical. They simply don't occur because, again, you have at least three groups of protections going on in this pilot to collect evidence. And again, those, you know, protections would be that, first of all, I've in fact worked with uninsured patients, very low income, as a volunteer for the last 20 years. And the experience is that those individuals can make very sound decisions, what's best for them, as long as they're provided with informed consent. And there is extremely thorough informed consent in this process.
Give them the choice. Yeah. Don't assume that they can't make the choice, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And this is not a market. This is, again, that it's going to be tightly regulated just as it is now. It is a tax credit that would come back from the federal government over a five-year period. And this amount of money, for example, was tested with Americans, in fact, American voters, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 2016, and 60% of people they interviewed who were voters said that they would favor compensation. So a number of the things that Dr. Kaplan, you know, respectfully brings up, I think, are illusions. Perhaps the last point I make is there are many, many other ethicists who disagree with this point of view. I have a quote here from Professor Jaworski at Georgetown, for example, we could read. But he simply says that for 40 years, we've had this problem. And he says at the end, we owe it to our family, friends, and neighbors to act. Compensation of donors through a highly regulated system is the best way forward.
And I want to, we want to talk to someone who actually stepped up and was an altruistic donor. Lauren, tell us a little bit about, you've been listening to this conversation. You were not compensated
Correct.
For your kidney donation.
Correct.
Walk us through what you went through to make this gift.
Yeah. So when I learned about living donation, I just thought, hey, I could do that. So I did it. I don't need the other kidney, right? But so I think a big thing that's happening here is oversimplification, right? We think like, oh, it's just like you're going to go in and donate blood. You're going to fill out this questionnaire and they're going to take your blood and you're good. They're going to give you $50,000 and out you go. In my experience, it was a lot of testing, a lot of dedication on my part. I went to an information session first, then a psych eval, tons of blood drawn. I mean, a lot very mm-hmm. often. It took 7 months before my donation. I had an EKG. I wore a heart monitor. I had to collect urine samples in a tub for 24 hours. There was no, it's not a pretty process. It's not an easy process.
You're saying it's not get rich quick.
Correct. It's not get rich quick. And the thing is that the medical professionals, if you are not qualified, you won't do it. They take your family history. If you have family history of any kind of kidney disease, you're not going to donate. So they're looking at like, what's your likelihood?
And Lauren, I got to ask you, I mean, what compensation have helped you going through this
Absolutely.
Process? You were 28 years old.
Yes.
Young.
Yes.
You know, probably not making a ton of money
Correct.
At the time.
Yes.
Would compensation have helped
Absolutely.
You?
And I was very lucky in that my lease ended in December. I donated in January, so I didn't renew it. I stayed with my parents. They took great care of me. But not everybody has that. I had to go back to work afterwards. You know, that's just what I had to do. And so it absolutely being incentivized would have helped. I would have done it either way. I think saying that the rich people are going to get the money, if you don't need it, you can donate that money. Nobody has to tell you what to do with that money. You don't have to squirrel it away. You mm-hmm. can, you know, you can give that to people. You can put it back in the donation or the donor fund or whatever. It's. I think it's kind of silly to say that the rich people are going to get that. And I also think it's kind of interesting to say that people who have money are the ones donating because, yeah, of course we are because we're not being compensated,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. So I could have afforded to do that. But if I did it now, maybe I couldn't because I have a child and a house and all that. Maybe I wouldn't be able to at this point in my life. So it's something to think about that more people would have the opportunity to participate in this if they were compensated.
Why isn't there a system that puts donors at the head of the list if they later need a kidney? That might reassure potential donors and could make donations more common. And I think we do have an answer to that question, but we have to get to that after the break. We are talking about living organ donation on Studio 2. Stick with us. This is 90.9.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are continuing our conversation about organ donation shortages and how to get more donors. Some people have suggested offering financial compensation, and we're talking about the thorny ethical issues that it could raise and other problems in the organ donation system.
We have three guests this hour. Let me reintroduce them. Dr. Gregory Hess is a physician and a transplant recipient and an advocate for compensating living donors. Lauren Shepherd is a living donor. She donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. And Art Kaplan is the Drs. William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Professor of Medical Ethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine. And we had that question before the break from Nancy about, you know,
if you donate
a kidney and then later, you know, you have problems with your remaining kidney, should you go to the top of the list? So let me direct that question to you, Lauren, because you're in that position. What happens after you give a kidney in terms of your priority for future treatment?
Yeah. So first, I do want to reiterate that you most likely will not be on the list if you are at high risk for future kidney disease. So you won't mm-hmm. be able to donate if the doctors see that you are a potential risk in the future. But as far as moved to the top list, you are. So I donated through the National Kidney Registry, which coordinates a lot of the altruistic donations in the country. And they do, it's a voucher system now. When I did it, it was just kind of like you get moved to the top of the list, I believe, yeah. But it was a little less organized. But now there's a voucher system. And I believe it even extends to your family members. So if my son, for instance, needed a kidney one day, he's going to get moved up because I donated a kidney to a stranger in the past.
Wow, very interesting. I want to bring in a caller. Joanne is on the line, wants to talk about the ethical issues. Joanne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My ethics is sort of convoluted about this. I would donate a kidney, but I would be offended if somebody offered to pay me for it.
Very interesting. And I want to also read another comment. Paul writes, yes, people should get paid. Poverty is raging. But no, I would not do it for money. I'd only do it to save key personal loved ones, if at all. But I'd help others in need find other donors. So there's this feeling there that it should be altruistic among some people. I want to bring Art back into the conversation. Art, you've heard, this conversation about a lot of people have hesitation about this the compensation. I want to talk about some of the other issues with the donation system. And one of the ones is you talked about the clogs that are in the matching. How could we fix that and open it up so that more people could get donations or be recipients of donors every single year?
Yeah, well, first, let me toss out one idea, Cherry, if I may. Dr. Hess, Ms. Shepherd, maybe we could agree on something. I'm not in favor of incentivizing with money people to sell their kidneys, but I am absolutely in favor of making sure that they don't incur costs. They're expenses. Mm. You have to go to a hotel. You have to find maybe some compensation for away from work, as Ms. Shepherd was talking about. There are other expenses, even making sure that you have health insurance. You don't want people selling kidneys who aren't insured, and there are plenty of underinsured and not insured people out there. So one thing to do is to fill the gap with money to help people who have legitimate expenses but still want to be an altruistic donor. That might be a position we might all agree on moving forward. That said, the system has trouble, the whole organ, the world of organ donation. It is running with inefficient software, outdated computers. They can't do quick matches. We lose too many potential organs that are donated because they don't get assigned to somebody whose blood type and antibody type might match. We have troubles making sure that an organ that appears maybe not to be 100% top quality still could be used in somebody who's much older and doesn't need a warranty of 40 years of life from their kidney. So the system needs reform. We also have inefficiencies. There's a system set up regional of organ procurement organizations, and the country is divided into areas, and they go out. When someone dies, they try to approach the family and ask if they would consider organ donation. That's fine, but there are some that just have terrible rates compared to others of people saying yes. They're not doing it well. They're either bullying the family or they're being inaccurate. We've got to fix the requests that go not so much for living donors, but for cadaver donors. And I'm going to repeat again, the system right now is in upheaval. There's worry that, in trying to fix the many problems that it has, it's fragile. And so going into the regulated sale market right now, tough thing to do. Might be better to take that step toward compensating reasonable expenses, see if that helps, motivates more people to think about it.
A middle road in a sense, yeah. And Greg Hess, let me bring you back in because you're a transplant recipient yourself. Yep. Mm-hmm. When you're getting on the list, we have this thing in quotes, the list, but it's really not that simple, right? Like you can call different centers. It sounds more chaotic in practice than, hey, I'm going to put myself on the list. I mean, when you went through this process, how did it work?
You know, at the end of the day, you know, my perspective is that the hospital systems in general are not well engineered for smooth sailing. Mm. At an individual level, the physicians and nurses and other people are compassionate, they're smart, they're incredibly hardworking. But in terms of adopting quickly best practices and uniformity, we certainly have a lot of room for improvement in that system, no question about it. And fully recognize what Dr. Kaplan's saying, and I would agree, you know, that there is inefficiencies that should be improved. And those, though, that he referred to are largely either occurring already and have not moved the needle. For example, donor expenses for out-of-pocket expenses are covered largely either by the National Living Donor Assistance Center, or they're covered by private groups such as the National Kidney Registry. And that hasn't moved the needle at all when we look at the trends of numbers of people who are dying on the wait list, who are not getting transplanted. So that's why we really feel strongly that then you have to look at other solutions. And again, you need to test them and to do studies. And this, for example, End Kidney Death Act is, again, a proposal to study this and look at the facts and data. If it doesn't move the needle, great, go on to the next solution. If it does, great, we've found something that's going to help living donors.
And let's talk about other solutions, because there are efforts to work on non-human organs that could help fill the gap. Mm-hmm. How close are we to that becoming a real option?
It's an interesting question. I actually review grants that are research grants looking at ways to do exactly what you're chatting about. So certainly, I'm sure we've all heard that there was a pig kidney specifically and specially genetically modified. There have been two transplanted recently, and to my last recollection, both of those recipients are doing well, which is great. So hopefully that will accelerate, but right, two people are not going to solve the problem, unfortunately, today. So we have a fairly long way to go before that would be really reviewed by the FDA in regular practice, et cetera, and really making a significant dent. But I hope it does work. That would be great. And then there are other devices that people have talked about and thought about. So hopefully those solutions will come in. I'm all in favor of incremental solutions if we can all piece them together. But right now, today, accelerating living donors is by far the best because it lasts twice as long as a deceased kidney. And that was largely the system reform that Dr. Kaplan's talking about. It's going to really work on the deceased kidney system.
Lauren, you decided to take this step and donate a kidney. In the meantime, assuming that there is no reform coming tomorrow, do you have conversations with people about this? Mm-hmm. Do people ask you about this? And what do you tell them? I'm not saying perhaps even necessarily that you try to convince them to do it, but what are those conversations like? And what do you tell people about the experience?
I would do it again in a heartbeat. Mm. I donated to a stranger, which is a very unique experience in that, like, I didn't get to choose who it went to or anything. I did meet him eventually, came to my wedding. We have a good relationship. So I'm very lucky in that aspect. But had I never met him, I still would do it again, just because to me it felt like the right thing to do. And I know that's not going to feel the same way for everybody, and that's completely understandable. But just for me, it felt like I was doing the right thing, and I still feel like I did the right thing. And at the end of the day, that's what gets me through, you know, helps me sleep at night. Yeah. but that being said, if the government was giving me a tax credit for it, I still would have done it.
Yeah, that's right.
And I want to read this comment from Alexis, who said, 2 years ago, I began the process of becoming a living non-directed kidney donor. I was denied the opportunity by the donation board because she had a medical condition. And the board decided that she was too much of a risk of not being able to deal with that process. She felt like a personal failure being turned down and wants to reapply. And so I want to sort of, we only have a couple more minutes, but I want to talk about the future of organ donation. I mean, this is something that saves a lot of lives. What does it look like? I mean, what should we be thinking about as we look into trying to make change and the likelihood of whether or not, you know, compensation will even become feasible.
Jerry, can I jump in?
Yeah, go ahead, Art.
A little bit, just for a little science fiction at the end. So I'm at the place where one of the pig kidneys was done at NYU. And I think so far, you know, so good. One of the gentlemen got it at the Mass General, but he died. But our recipient is still okay. I think we are 3 or 4, 5 years away from having this either established or giving up, but it is a path. Freezing organs is an interesting idea because if you could bank them and start to store them, that's a technology that people are working on very aggressively. The longer term way to perhaps solve some of our problems is to try and reduce the need for the kidneys. So we got a lot of diabetes and a lot of obesity in the U.S. Maybe our injectable drugs will help us reduce those rates because kidney failure, you know, they're genetic forms, but they're definitely lifestyle related problems. And we got to work on that. We don't want to just transplant as a solution. We want to get into prevention as a solution. So weirdly enough, the world of the injectable drugs, lowering weight, helping diabetics, helping against heart disease, this may help reduce the demand because it's been escalating and escalating. I'm going to say primarily due to lifestyle issues.
Well, they say, and I think maybe even Ben Franklin was the first to say this, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So we'll end on that Philly note, that Philly connection. I want to thank everybody. This is a fascinating conversation. It's an important conversation, and it's an evolving conversation. So we're going to keep it going. Again, our guests were Art Kaplan, professor of medical ethics at NYU's Grossman School of Medicine, Dr. Gregory Hess, physician and a transplant recipient himself, and Lauren Shepherd, who donated her kidney to a stranger 10 years ago. Thank you all for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show.
Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Andreas Copes, and John Ahrens. Al Banks engineered today's show. Kevin McCrory is our executive producer. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks for joining us.
Tomorrow at noon, we will be back for another hour of Studio 2. And we want to remind you that you can always get in contact with us. The email is studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 215-351-0525 and tell us what's on your mind.
And you can find us wherever you get your podcasts or at whyy.org. We would really love to hear from you. Coming up next, it's Here and Now.